Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's March 2018, and you're listening to episode 64 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. James Anderson, who is Associate Professor of Theology and Philosophy at Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, and he completed his PhD in Philosophical Theology at the University of Edinburgh on the topic of paradox in Christian theology. He is the author of three books, including Why Should I Believe in Christianity? And he has also written an article for a recent issue of our journal in the Volume 40, number 5 issue, and it's called The Inescapability of God. In addition, his current book project is he's working on an introduction to the philosophy of David Hume. James, it's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you say in your article in the introduction that there's nothing more foundational in Christian apologetics than the existence of God, of course, but you also note that modern people in modern society tend to doubt or deny that God exists. So given all of this, how did you first get interested in Christian apologetics?
Well, that's a great question. I got into apologetics probably during my postgraduate studies. I was an engineering undergraduate, and I didn't really, although I was a believer, I hadn't really explored the intellectual dimensions of my faith. So while I was doing postgraduate studies, I found I came into contact with a lot of intelligent unbelievers. And so I started reading a lot of material on apologetics so I could try and answer their various questions. So I started reading a lot of apologetics material, but it wasn't really until I read John Frame's book, Apologetics to the Glory of God, that I started to see the deep connection between theology and apologetics. And I experienced just a bit of a sort of paradigm shift in my views. But anyway, I continued studying apologetics, theology, philosophy, trying to equip myself well, completed a couple of degrees in Christian philosophy and apologetics. And then it was eventually, some years later, hired by a seminary to teach apologetics, among other things, for a living.
That's kind of a jump from engineering to Christian apologetics and theology.
Yeah, a lot of people think that, but I think there's a connection in that they're both very left-brained activities. You know, I'm very analytical and systematic in my thinking. So I tell people that when I moved from computing to philosophy, I kept thinking the same way, but it was just the subject matter that changed.
Well, you mentioned in your article that there are aspects of our lives that every person takes for granted, but that you think can only be adequately explained on a theistic basis. So is it possible to demonstrate the existence of God?
I think it is possible to demonstrate the existence of God, and I tried to do something like that in the article. But you can't demonstrate the existence of God like other things, like you demonstrate the existence of other things, especially things within the space-time universe. Take, for example, something like the Loch Ness Monster. So someone claims, oh, there's this monster that lives in Loch Ness. Well, how do you demonstrate its existence? Well, you have to use scientific methods, empirical methods. You have to do observations and so forth. And you can use that same sort of method for proving the existence of God, because God is a radically different kind of being than anything in the universe. God isn't a thing in the universe at all. God is the transcendent creator and sustainer of the whole universe. And so what that means, I think, is that while we can't perceive God in the way that we perceive things in the universe, we can nonetheless infer God's existence as a kind of precondition of our ability to perceive things within the universe. In other words, only if God exists as the transcendent creator and sustainer of the universe, would we be able to make sense of all the ordinary things that we do perceive in the world? And even the fact that there is a world that we can inhabit and perceive things and experience things within, that actually presupposes the existence of God. So I think in that sort of indirect way, we can show that God's existence is necessary.
Well, in the article you wrote for us, you discussed six arguments for the existence of God, and I'd like you to walk our listeners through each one of those arguments. So can you summarize the first one that you give in the article?
Sure. The first argument I call the argument from existence, and it's a fairly familiar one. I give my own version of it, but it starts with the undeniable fact that something exists. Things exist. We could point to things out there in the world, or we could point to ourselves. I have to assume my own existence. But most of the things that we experience in the world exist contingently. That is to say, they exist, but they didn't have to exist. They might not have existed. That's true of me. That's true of a tree out in the yard. All of these things, although they exist contingently. There's nothing necessary about their existence. But whenever you come across something that exists contingently, that begs the question, why does it exist? Why does it exist at all? If it didn't have to exist, but it does exist, what's the explanation for why it exists? And that's true of my existence. It's true of the existence of the tree. It's true of the existence of the universe as a whole, because the universe, the space-time universe, is just one big contingent object. Now, how do you explain the existence of something? Well, you have to appeal to something else, something outside of it. And you can't keep on appealing to more and more contingent things to say, well, this contingent thing explains that contingent thing's existence, and so on and so on. At some point, you need to come to a final explanation, an ultimate explanation in a being that's not contingent, what we would call a necessary being. And that is exactly the kind of being that God is. God is a necessarily existent being, a self-existent being. And so only God, I would argue, can explain the existence of anything at all, ultimately.
Well, I know that there's some skeptics out there that would say that this argument invites that, you know, typical question, if God created the universe, then who created God? So how should Christian apologists respond to this?
Yeah, this is a very common comeback when you use this kind of argument. If you're arguing, well, God created the universe, that explains why the universe exists, that God created it. The obvious comeback is, or at least the tempting comeback is, well, in that case, who created God? What explains God's existence? But that fails to recognize that God is not at all the same kind of being as the universe. The universe, as I said a moment ago, is a contingent thing, and therefore it needs an external explanation. There has to be something beyond the universe to explain why it exists. But God, by definition, not a contingent being. God, if there is a God, God would have to be a necessarily existent being, because God is a maximally great being. He's perfect in every respect. And that means that he couldn't be dependent on some other being, because then he wouldn't be God. He wouldn't be the greatest being. There'd be some other being who would be God. So once you understand what kind of a being God is, that God is a self-existent, necessary being, then this question doesn't even arise. The objection really is based on a false assumption.
Well, your second and third arguments about God and values and God and morality seem like they go together. So can you explain those and how they're related? And it seems to me that a lot of atheists out there would say that we don't need God to explain morality or to be moral.
Right. Yes. So the second and third arguments that I talk about in the article are the argument from values and the argument from morality. And they are closely related. Often it's said, atheists will say, well, you don't need to believe in God to be moral. Well, I agree. I mean, there are plenty of atheists who behave very morally uprightly. They know the difference between right and wrong. So I'm not saying that you need to believe in God in order to be moral. Rather, I'm saying that in order for there to be such a thing as morality and as objective values, there needs to be a God. God needs to objectively exist in order for that to be the case. So the second argument is the argument from values. And it starts with the observation that we make various value judgments about the world. We do this all the time. We say this is good and this is bad. This thing is right. This thing is wrong. This thing is the way it should be. This thing isn't the way that it should be. So we make these value judgments. We're not just stating facts. We're saying this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. Now, some of these judgments that we make are obviously subjective, like, chocolate ice cream is good, vanilla ice cream is bad, this kind of music is good, this kind is bad. But there are many value judgments that we make that are objective, that we don't think, they're just matters of personal taste or feeling. So, for example, the discovery of antibiotics was a good thing. It was an objectively good thing. The Holocaust and the Nazi regime, these were not objectively good. These were objectively bad, indeed evil things. So once we recognize that we're making these objective value judgments, we should also recognize that they presuppose some sort of standard. There has to be an objective standard or criterion or measure of value that is independent of us and independent of the world, because we're applying it to the world. You can't make the world itself the measure of goodness, because the world is a mixture of good and bad. So if there's some standard, it has to be external to the world. It has to be independent of the world and independent of us. What that means then is there has to be something that is absolutely good. There has to be something external to the world and outside of us that is simply good in itself, good by definition. The problem for atheists who typically hold to a naturalist worldview is that there can be no such thing by definition, because the universe, the natural universe, is all there is. There could be nothing that could serve as that objective standard or criterion. Whereas theists, of course, have a very ready answer to this, because God is pure goodness. God is absolute goodness. And so the very nature and character of God serves as that absolute objective criterion of good and bad, of right and wrong. So it fits together in a way that the naturalist worldview does not. And then very briefly, to move to the third argument, this is the argument from morality, and it's really just the second argument applied specifically to the topic of moral values. And I think in practice, this argument is often more effective, because if you talk about values in a very general sense, it sounds rather abstract. But when you get to the specific topic of moral values, that becomes very concrete, that becomes very personally relevant for people, because everybody is invested in some sort of moral code or moral value system. They recognize that there are certain things that they regard as morally right and morally wrong. They may not agree with Christians about these things, but they will certainly have certain moral principles that they apply. And once we recognize that, once we accept that there are moral values, it's a short step to recognize that everyone recognizes some sort of moral absolute. No one, despite what they claim, is a pure moral relativist who thinks that every moral principle is up for grabs or could be different than it is or varies. So once we recognize that there are certain moral absolutes, such as caring for our children, treating other people with respect. Of course, there's a lot of talk at the moment about sexual propriety in the media and so forth. And people recognize there are certain things that are just intrinsically wrong. If that's the case, then there have to be some moral absolutes. And those moral absolutes can't depend on us. They can't be things that we invented, because if they were, there were things that we could change. So when we make these moral judgments, we're presupposing that there are some moral laws that are independent of us, immoral laws, moral principles that transcend human societies, human cultures. Now, if you're an atheist, if you hold to a naturalistic worldview, which I think is the most consistent form of atheism, you got to ask the question, where could these moral laws possibly come from? There is no transcendent realm that could be the source of these moral values, and the universe itself is just a big physical object that can't generate moral laws. So for the atheistic naturalist, what could be the source of those kind of moral laws? But again, the Christian theist has a very ready answer to this. There are laws because there is a lawgiver. There are absolute moral laws because there is an absolute moral lawgiver, namely God. It's a very straightforward answer to the question of what grounds these moral laws that we really all take for granted.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. James Anderson, and James wrote a feature article in the Volume 40, Number 5 issue of our journal called The Inescapability of God. And this article is based on his book, Why Should I Believe in Christianity?, which is available to you as one of the equipping essential resources for your first gift when you join the CRI support team. So to join CRI's team, please go to equip.org. We were just discussing the argument of God and morality, and in that section of the article, you make reference to what are called hard atheists. Can you explain to our listeners what a hard atheist is?
Yeah, so this is a fun term that I didn't invent, but I actually picked up from an atheist philosopher by the name of Joel Marx, who wrote an article in the magazine Philosophy Now a number of years ago entitled An Amoral Manifesto. He had written on the topic of morality for many years, written a column on morality. But in this article, Professor Marx came out as an amoralist. He said, I used to think that morality was a real thing, but now I've come to the conclusion that, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as morality. And he went on to explain that the reason for this was that he had recognized a connection between his atheism and his understanding of morality. And the short version is, he realized that moral laws, if there are moral laws, then they're like commands or commandments. They're sort of imperatives or injunctions. But if there are moral commands, then there has to be a moral commander. You can't have commands without a commander. And he says, I'm an atheist. I don't believe that there is such a commander. So I don't believe that there are such commands. And therefore, since I'm an atheist, I have to also be an amoralist, someone who denies that morality is real. And he says, he's unlike a lot of atheists, whom he calls soft atheists. A soft atheist is someone who denies the existence of God, but still thinks morality is real. And he says, well, I consider myself now a hard atheist. A hard atheist is someone who recognizes that if there is no God, then there is no such thing as morality. And since they don't believe that there's a God, they're also committed to denying the existence of morality. And he sort of mocks the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and so forth as being softies. He actually calls them softies because he thinks that they haven't really grasped the full implications of atheism. And that's very useful, I think, in Christian apologetics to say, look, this argument from morality is actually relying on something that not just Christians recognize, but there are even atheists who recognize this connection between the existence of God and morality.
Well, one of the things that you discuss is the argument of God and reason. And I think in modernity, people think of faith, God, prayer as this thing that's, just experiential and based on feelings, whereas other things like science and reason are things that are based on fact. So you really can't connect those things. But how would you say that human reason points people to God?
Yeah, so there is, you're right, there's this common view that faith and reason are sort of opposite, or they operate in different spheres. So you can either go on the basis of reason or you can go on the basis of faith. And I think atheists are particularly fond of claiming that Christians rely on faith, whereas they, the atheists, rely on reason. And what I do in the article with my fourth argument is I make the case that reason itself points us to God. Reason itself presupposes the existence of God. And the argument can be spelled out in various ways, but the basic idea is this, that we all recognize that we have reasoning capacities. In fact, it's really an amazing thing that human beings have the capacity to reason, to make judgments between what is true and what is false, to take some truths and to infer other truths from them, to extend our knowledge of the world with logical inference and evidence and so forth. And we take this for granted, but we rely on it all the time. Now, how can this be? What explains how we have this capacity for reasoning? Well, the Christian worldview has a very ready explanation for this capacity, because our reason is derivative of God's reason. God is a rational being. God thinks. God is able to reason. We might say that God is the supreme intellect. And we, the Bible tells us, are made in God's image. And so we reflect various capacities of God and attributes of God on a very limited, finite level. And that means that we have a derivative capacity to reason. Just as God is truth and always knows truth and loves truth, so he has given us a capacity to grasp truth, to understand truth, to seek truth. And so what we might say is that God's absolute original intellect underwrites our finite intellects. So there's a Christian explanation for this. Whereas atheist worldviews face real difficulties explaining how reason came from non-reason, because that's what you're committed to on an atheist view. If we are rational beings, but we came from non-rational beings, lower animals and originally single-celled organisms, how is it that blind, unconscious, unintelligent natural processes can bestow reason upon us? How does reason come from non-reason? See, the thing is that atheists always want to get something for nothing. We saw that with the argument from existence, that, you know, you want to get something that exists out of nothing. Likewise, morality. You have to try and get morality out of something that's non-moral, nature itself. And it's the same with rationality, that the atheist is committed to trying to get an explanation for reason that comes from purely non-rational entities and processes. So whereas the Christian worldview moves from the greater to the lesser, from God to human reason, atheist worldviews really have to move in the opposite direction. They have to get something far greater out of something ultimately infinitely less, ultimately just nothing at all. And so there's more that could be said about this argument, but that's the basic idea of how a Christian theistic worldview can account for our reasoning capabilities in a way that an atheistic naturalistic worldview cannot.
Well, your fifth argument deals with the mind and consciousness. And so how does consciousness differ from the argument from reason that you just explained?
Yeah, again, these arguments are quite closely related, although I think they are distinct arguments. This fifth argument from mind and consciousness digs a little deeper than the previous one. A moment ago, I talked about reason, our capacity to reason. But in order to reason at all, you need a conscious mind. Only conscious minds can entertain thoughts, can have beliefs, can reflect consciously upon the logical connections between them. You just can't imagine reasoning without having a mind, a conscious mind that engages in that reasoning process. Now, the trouble for the atheist here is that he is committed to a purely naturalistic explanation of human origins, basically some sort of naturalistic evolutionary story that human beings have emerged from lower organisms, and all of this is explicable in terms of physics and chemistry, naturalistic processes, naturalistic materials. But that implies that consciousness can arise out of entirely non-conscious material structures and processes. Really, the atheist is committed to the view that matter preceded mind. This is one of the age-old philosophical questions. Which came first, matter or mind, and how do they relate? Well, the atheist is typically committed to the idea that matter precedes mind, and mind can be explained in terms of matter. And yet, no scientist or philosopher has really come close to explaining how this first-person conscious perspective on the world could be generated by physical material structures. And in fact, it doesn't seem like that's even possible in principle. It's like a category error, because minds have properties that are utterly unlike material or physical properties. So that's the problem of getting consciousness out of entirely material physical processes. And Christian theists, of course, don't face that problem, because we're not committed to the view that mind precedes, or that matter precedes mind, and that we have to reduce mind to matter. In fact, if anything, we take the view that mind precedes matter, but not our mind, God's mind. God's mind is the original mind, and so we don't face the kind of difficulties in accounting for the existence of real consciousness and mentality in the universe.
Well, naturalists, some of them often claim that consciousness, like morality, can be explained in evolutionary terms. Although before this podcast, I was telling you that one professor that I spoke to, was an engineering professor, agreed that naturalism cannot specifically account for consciousness. But what do you think is wrong with that claim, that naturalists can explain consciousness with evolution?
Right. So it's very common for atheists to appeal to some sort of evolutionary explanation for morality, for rationality, and for consciousness. In the case of consciousness, I think the basic problem is that evolution can't create something out of nothing. It can only work with what is already there. Natural selection can only operate on things that already exist. So if you've got an organism and by some sort of random genetic mutation, it ends up with a longer beak or a longer limb, and that confers a survival advantage, then yes, natural selection could select for that. But when you're talking about selecting for a higher form of consciousness over a lower form of consciousness, or more basically, selecting for a conscious organism over a non-conscious organism, you already have to have consciousness there to select for it. And evolutionary accounts actually have to assume the mysterious emergence of consciousness from physical structures rather than explaining it. The mere process of evolution doesn't explain how consciousness could arise out of material structures in the first place.
Well, your last argument in the article deals with the fact that science presupposes the existence of God. So how do you summarize this? Explain that to our listeners.
Sure. The basic idea with this last argument is that science itself, the process of scientific research and scientific investigation, relies on a host of philosophical assumptions about truth, about our ability to reason, about the uniformity of the natural world in space and time, certain moral principles that scientists in practice have to assume, mathematics and the relationship between mathematics and the physical world. These are all kinds of philosophical assumptions that science rests upon. But these assumptions are largely inexplicable in terms of an atheistic, naturalistic worldview, whereas they fit very neatly, very naturally, we might say, into a biblical theistic worldview. Once you draw out these assumptions, there's a good fit with a biblical worldview, but in an atheistic worldview, they tend to be arbitrary and unjustified. Just to give you a couple of examples that I use in the article, two assumptions that science makes. First, that the universe is an orderly and rational place. And secondly, that the orderliness and rationality of the universe aligns with the orderliness and rationality of our minds. That is, that there's a fit between the objective universe and the structures of our minds. Now, these are assumptions that science makes, but science can't prove those assumptions. It has to assume them in order to do, in order for anyone to do science, they have to be assumed. We ourselves are not in a position to confirm these empirically. We can't observe every point in the universe to see that it's orderly and rational. We can't get outside our minds to check that they fit with the objective universe. But God is in a position. God is in a unique position to establish these assumptions and confirm them. God knows that the universe is orderly and rational precisely because he made it. He created it. He sustains it. And by means of revelation, natural revelation, and special revelation, we too can know derivatively that this is an orderly, rational universe. And that was actually the assumption that drove the pioneering scientists such as Newton and Boyle to have confidence that they could understand the universe that we live in.
Well, I know that there's some people out there that take the view that these arguments for the existence of God are unnecessary. So how do you respond to them?
Yeah, I do sympathize with this view to some extent. I don't think you need arguments for the existence of God in order to have a perfectly respectable and rational belief in God. I mean, my grandmother was a more pious, faithful believer than I will ever be. And I don't think she could formulate a single argument for the existence of God. And if your faith depends on them, then I think there's probably something wrong. I think belief in God is actually a natural product of general revelation. I think that's what Paul teaches in Romans chapter 1, that everyone can immediately perceive the existence of God from the created order. However, I do think there's something useful about showing that our natural belief in God is confirmed by reason, that it makes philosophical sense, that it stands up to scrutiny, and in fact that our belief in God makes sense of a lot of other things that we take for granted. And once we see that, that can strengthen our faith, it can deepen our faith, we can gain a greater intellectual appreciation for our faith. And I think it's glorifying to God to show that all of these things in our everyday experience, morality, values, science, reason, all the rest of it, ultimately depend on him. It's glorifying to God to make that connection and demonstrate it to others.
Well, finally, I want you to just tell us a little bit more about your book, Why I Should Believe in Christianity, where you develop some of these arguments in more detail. It's one of our selection of resources that people could pick if they join the CRI support team. So can you tell us a little bit more about your book?
Sure. So the title of the book is Why Should I Believe Christianity? It's actually part of a series that I'm co-editing called The Big Ten, that answer major questions that skeptics, unbelievers ask about the faith. And these books are directed towards unbelievers. They'll be useful for Christians for sure, but they're written to be understood by skeptics, unbelievers. And my contribution is to make as concisely and as clearly as possible a basic case for the Christian worldview, for believing that there's a God who has revealed himself, that the Bible is God's word, that Jesus was indeed the Son of God who rose from the dead. These basic components of a Christian worldview, I try and explain what a Christian worldview is and why it makes sense of the world in a way that alternative views do not. And I do that in maybe a couple hundred pages, and in a way that avoids philosophical jargon, Christianese, and all the rest of things that can put people off.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for James. So obviously, from your accent, you're not originally from America, and I know you're from the UK, but are you an American citizen?
No, I'm not, although I am the father of an American citizen. So my wife and my two daughters moved here some 9 years ago, but we now have a son who was born here, and he has an American passport. So we're permanent residents. We're definitely legal here, but we're not yet citizens, and we're actually at the point where we could become ones if we so choose.
Well, fish and chips or a full English breakfast?
Depends what time of day it is, of course, but probably all else being equal, fish and chips. I so rarely get the chance to eat that now that I would jump at the opportunity.
And how do you take your tea?
Rarely would be the answer. I'm a coffee drinker, not a tea drinker. My parents raised me to drink tea by the gallon, but when I got to university, I discovered the glories of coffee, and I've never really looked back.
And tennis or cricket?
Definitely tennis. I was forced to play cricket at school, and I hated it, so that scarred me for life. Whereas knocking a tennis ball about, yeah, I could definitely get behind that.
Well, there's going to be a royal wedding coming up, so who is your favorite royal?
My favorite royal? right now, it would be the Queen. I just think she's a very admirable person. As best I can tell, she seems to have a sincere Christian faith, and I think she's been through a lot and has come through it with her honor and integrity intact. So, yeah, God save the Queen.
Well, thanks, James, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Today's guest is James Anderson, and James wrote a feature article for the Volume 40, Number 5 issue called The Inescapability of God. And this article is based on his book, Why Should I Believe Christianity?, which is available to you as one of the Equipping Essential Resources for your first gift when you join the CRI support team. So to join CRI's team and get James' book, go to equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter, and follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and we need you to rate and review our podcast so other people can find it. And we'd like you to share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Hank is also regularly live streaming on Facebook and YouTube, so please go to equip.org for dates and times. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, which is Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.